Hello and welcome back, everyone. So far, we've focused on linear problems, on scalar equations, but also systems of equations. And today I would like to start the discussion of the nonlinear problem. So nonlinear conservation laws, both the scalar equations, but also systems of equations. And so this chapter will essentially lay the foundation for the numerical methods that are to come that we are going to discuss in the in a subsequent chapter. So this is essentially the necessary theoretical discussion on the analytic level of some of the properties that we encounter in these systems on the nonlinear level. So in particular, we're going to focus in this chapter on a system of conservation laws of the following form that is given here. So where U is our state vector that lives in Rm, where M is the number of conservation laws that we have. So this is our solution, our state vector. We're considering problems in 1D for now. So this means that these solutions are defined on the real axis R, and our time coordinate will be from some initial time t0 to infinity. So what we're going to show first is essentially that there are no classical solutions to these systems of equations, at least in a global sense. And by classical, we mean essentially continuously differentiable solutions to the problem. We'll show, however, that such solutions always exist locally, but we will never find such a solution, or say in general, we will not find such a solution globally in space and time. This will lead us to the definition of so-called weak solutions, which are solutions of the integral type. It will turn out that these solutions are not unique, and so given an initial value problem, there are potentially multiple solutions to that problem in the weak sense. And so what we're going to do is then define a so-called entropy condition that is supposed to restore the uniqueness of solutions in the weak solution space. So in a sense, you can think of this entropy condition as a condition essentially that will help us to pick out the physical solution that we are actually interested in. And finally, we'll discuss the Riemann problem in quite some detail. So that is essentially the initial value problem for discontinuous initial data, for certain discontinuous initial data. And we'll also discuss some of the nonlinear wave solutions that it gives rise to. So this is essentially, we'll discuss this in quite some detail, because essentially the Riemann problem will turn out to be really the centerpiece of numerical schemes for conservation laws that we're going to discuss afterwards, the so-called Godunov type schemes and all the schemes that are derived from that idea that really puts the Riemann problem locally as to the heart of the algorithm. Okay, let us start proceeding in this way with showing that essentially there cannot be classical solutions to this problem globally, and we'll then show that at least locally we can expect those to exist. So this is 4.1 local existence of classical solutions. And so I just start by noting essentially what I already formulated, that even in the case of smooth initial data, there are, in general, nor continuous. Solutions that exist. Globally in time. And the first example will essentially demonstrate this. This is very well-known and effective counterexample. Let's look at the Invissel-Burgers equation that we've encountered previously. So this is the scalar problem ut plus f ux equals zero with the following flux, f of u equals 1/2 u squared. And let's say we consider some smooth initial data, u naught. Given by the following form, where we set it to constant in the domain minus infinity to minus one, and we set it to zero in one to infinity. And then in between, we actually don't care too much as long as it smoothly interpolates between these two constants. And we'll just assume that it just monotonically decreases to zero in that regime. Now let's look at the characteristics of this problem. So which, as you may remember, are the curves defined in the following way. So where gamma prime, so it's d gamma by dt equals lambda of u, which is our notation for f prime of u, and gamma at t equals zero is given by x zero. Okay, so it is now easy to show that the solution stays constant on gamma, and I believe we have already shown this in the nonlinear case in chapter one. So just as a brief reminder of this, let's just look at how the solution changes along the characteristic. So this is just ut plus gamma prime ux. And so with the definition of gamma prime, definition of the characteristic that satisfies the conservation law, so that is zero. So u actually does not change along the characteristic, and also it is a straight line, in fact, meaning that gamma prime is constant. So this follows from the following calculation. So just by definition, this is f of u gamma t comma t, which, since u doesn't change along the characteristic, is u at gamma of zero, so at x zero, just translated along the characteristic. So this is f prime of u zero at x zero, which means that it's constant. So U is constant along the characteristics, and the characteristics are straight lines. So now let's interpret this for the current example. So here we have gamma prime is f prime of u naught x naught . I'll just write it out again explicitly. So u of gamma naught . Which means that a characteristic gamma x naught starting let's say one point in our domain from minus infinity to minus one or in contrast, from 1 to plus infinity, has a slope of 1 or 0, according to our definition above here. And so u is also 1 or 0, depending on the case, these two cases. So now let's try to sketch this a little bit, and so we'll then immediately see the consequence. So let's draw the initial data first. So this is x, and this is u naught. And so say here's minus one, plus one, then our initial data is given by something like this, where here we have one, so it's a nice and smooth function. So if we now try to construct the solution into the Invissenberger's equation. And again, let's say we start here minus one and here's plus one. Now, if we draw the characteristics to construct the solution, we'll get the following. So in this interval from one to infinity, we'll just have these straight lines as characteristics. And in contrast, if we look at the domain from minus infinity to minus one, we have characteristics with slope one here. And so they will go like this. Right? And so in between, as I said, we're not too interested in the details, but somehow these characteristics will go something like this, interpolate between these two limiting regimes. So what you can see here is essentially that at some finite time, we see this, we witness essentially this phenomenon of intersecting, crossing characteristics. So let's denote this as some finite time t. Oops. Let's say this is T equals capital T. Now here, and so from this we can immediately deduce, since the solution along these characteristics up here is actually zero, right? And the solution along these characteristics stays one, according to what we found out here. So clearly, since these characteristics meet here, the solution cannot be continuous anymore. So which means that this finite time capital T, the domain of the classical solution, breaks down. So let me get this here. So clearly at this point when the characteristics start to intersect, the solution is sort of ill-defined in this classical sense. Now we can actually view this in a sort of little broader context, if you want. So this is one specific example where we see this breakdown of classical solutions. But in principle, this is just one example of a slightly more general observation, which is this phenomenon of wave steepening. That I just wanted to briefly discuss here. So consider the following. Let's say again, we restrict ourselves to scalar problems. So scalar conservation law with smooth initial conditions. And so the only important assumption that, so this will be fairly general, and the only important assumption that we're going to make here is that we have a nonlinear problem, meaning that the flux is either convex or concave, at least for some parts of the of Rm, so of the sort of space in which our solution lives. So convex flux function for now, we'll just assume we're in the convex case. Similar arguments, analogous arguments, say hold in the case of a concave function. So let's assume that second derivative of f with respect to u is actually greater than zero. And so note that this is actually, so in the linear case, what we're going to discuss will not hold because f double prime is necessarily zero, because in the linear case, typically what we have is that lambda say f prime, so lambda of u or f prime of u is actually a constant, which is the advection speed, for example, in the advection equation, or in the case of a system, we just have a matrix, capital A or so, with constant coefficients. So in the linear case, f double prime is identically zero. And this phenomenon of wave steepening is not present. So this is really a distinctive nonlinear feature. So let's just try to draw some initial data to illustrate the consequence of convex flux functions. So let's say we just have something like it looks like this. Goes down here. And let's try to draw the initial part of the characteristics that arise from this initial data. Let's pick a few points. Something like here, maybe. Something in between. And something like here. Let's assume that the characteristic for a given U here will be essentially this straight line. So now since the flux function is actually concave, larger values of u will actually travel faster than lower values of u. So if we go a little bit to the right, where u has increased a little bit, we will travel faster, meaning that our characteristic will have will be a little bent like this. And even more so if we go to the next point to the right, and so here this is even further bent. Okay, and now here we are back essentially to the same value as before. And so here, we're actually traveling in the sort of reverse direction. Okay, so essentially what we have here is, so this being the maximum initial data, then what we have here is essentially a compressive region where essentially characteristics start to converge. So this is what we call a compressive region. And contrast here, we have an expansion sort of an expansive region where the characteristics start to diverge. So and in the other case in which we have a concave function, then simply the meaning, essentially the role of the two will be interchanged, will be reversed. So let me just write this down. AE and IC reversed for concave flux. And so the existence, the mere existence of these two regimes means that at some point we have crossing of characteristics, as in the previous example of the inverted Burgers equation, which is actually just one sort of sub-example of this sort of larger class of problems. And so this is where what we essentially call then wave breaking, so that a wave steepens and finally breaks, which is exactly the point where the derivative of the solution essentially diverges. So let me just write this down. So existence of IE and IC will eventually lead to crossing characteristics and, as in the above case, to multivalued solutions . And this is what we refer to as the wave breaks. The first crossing of characteristics. And this is essentially defined where ux goes to infinity. This is something one can easily understand essentially from the previous picture. So we again look at the context here. Again, here we have a contractive region, so a compressive region between essentially between minus one and infinity. And so what we see here is that at some point we'll have a crossing of characteristics. And so this derivative part here, this monotonically decreasing part here, will be essentially shrunk to an infinitely small sort of point in space. And so the derivative here will be essentially forced to diverge, and the function at this crossing point becomes discontinuous. So let's see how we can estimate essentially this crossing time, this breaking point. So again, let's sort of write the solution in terms of characteristics. So we construct a solution through characteristics. We'll show in a second that such a construction always exists, and that follows essentially from the inverse function theorem. So we can write down the solution as u of gamma of t comma t for some characteristic that goes through this point, and tracing that back to t equals zero leads us to u naught at x naught, which is just following back x along this characteristic through x times t. And so this is our x naught. Now from here we can see that ux is given by u naught prime x zero, and we were assuming that the initial data is differentiable. Dx naught by dx. Now we know that. So in order to compute this part, we know that from above here, we know that x is x naught plus lambda at u naught of x naught times t. And so dx by dx naught is 1 plus lambda prime u naught at x naught times u prime x naught at x naught times t, which is 1 plus lambda x t. And so now looking for when essentially this, when ux diverges, we'll find the following condition. From up here, we deduce that this is when dx by dx naught has a zero. And so plugging in the expression from the right here, we'll see that this breaking time is given by one minus one over lambda prime at u naught x naught . Okay, so we're essentially, so we see essentially that breaking occurs, maybe let me write this down, breaking occurs first for that characteristic gamma x naught, for which lambda x of u naught x naught smaller than zero. So obviously we want to have a positive finite time, and where the absolute value of that is maximal, so that t break is minimal. So this gives us essentially a recipe how to calculate that breaking point given a flux function and sort of given such an equation and initial data u naught. Okay, so this is essentially to say that these classical solutions up to some finite time t break, so this is what we actually called capital T initially for the Invested-Burgers problem. So at some finite time T break, the classical solution will sort of break down, lead to some discontinuous solution. And so we cannot expect for these problems such C1, such continuously differentiable solutions to exist. However, what we can assume is the following, namely that at least locally in time, such classical solutions exist. So the statement is, let's say we have some flux function that is at least twice continuously differentiable. We have some differentiable initial data. We'll assume that everything is well behaved, meaning that the flux function as well as the initial data are bounded, or say more specifically that some of their derivatives are bounded, then there exists the finite time capital T greater than zero such that the initial value problem for scalar conservation laws has a classical solution. Up to this point in time, capital T. So let me just quickly show this. The idea is essentially construct this with characteristics and then to reformulate it in a way that we can invoke the implicit function theorem that then sort of locally in time guarantees a solution. So let's focus on some arbitrary point x, t in our domain, and let's consider the characteristic through that point . So then let's again invoke some of the identities that we've already derived above. So x naught is given by x minus lambda u naught x naught times t. So following the point back on its characteristic. So this is x minus f prime of u naught x naught times t by definition. And then since u is constant, so the solution is constant along the characteristic, then we can just write this as f prime of u of x comma t times t. And now we can essentially write this as a problem for the implicit function theorem, as I mentioned. So let's write this in the following way. Let's write the solution as u of x naught comma zero. It's constant along the characteristic. So this is x naught of u naught of x naught. Equals, again, you can plug in the expression for x naught from above. So this is f x minus f prime of u comma x comma t times t. And now we can define a function capital F following way, where we just define this to be v minus u naught of x minus f prime of f of v, times t. Now we suspect that if v actually equals u, meaning the solution, the classical solution to the problem, meaning that capital F has a zero, that would correspond to the solution to our problem. And we'll show this in a second. First, we'll just show that such a solution exists. So we know that F at u0 of x comma x, comma 0 is 0, so that the initial data is obviously a solution. Is a 0 of this function by construction. And also we know that the first derivative with respect to V of capital F is just 1 minus U naught prime second derivative of F with respect to T times T. And that is in general non-vanishing. So with these two conditions of F having a zero and the first derivative not vanishing, we can invoke the implicit function theorem that then tells us that a solution to this exists locally for finite t. So for t sufficiently small, and so the stress here is really on sufficiently small, there exists a function u that satisfies, the condition two that we've just written down. So this essentially guarantees the existence of such a function u for a finite time. And now let's just make sure that this actually solves the problem. So knowing that such a function u exists, let's see how this solves our conservation law, the initial value problem. So dx by dt equals zero according to one is then equal to dx0 by dt plus f prime u naught x naught plus second derivative u naught prime times t. And so just reorganizing these terms, f prime u naught x naught plus 1 plus f double prime u0 x0 u0 prime x naught times t. Okay, so we know that dx0 by dt is given by minus f prime u0 x0 divided by 1 plus f double prime of u0 of x0 u0 prime . Okay, so we'll need this in just a second. And so here you can also see why we needed these derivatives of the flux function and of the initial data to be bounded. So we also know that obviously this is 1. So according again to the above definition, up here, we can calculate dx naught by dx plus f double prime u naught of x naught . And so here we have dx naught by dx. So this provides us dx naught by dx equals 1 plus 1 over 1 over 1 plus f double prime u naught of x naught u naught prime of x0 t. Okay. So let's see what we get from using the second relation. So this again was our formulation here, this part. So if we differentiate with respect to time, we get u0 prime of x times dx 0 by dt. So this is just using this part here and reusing this right formulation up here on the right here. It's minus u0 prime . So this is just plugging in the result that we just derived, 0 prime t . So excuse me, this is actually using this this identity here, and so we're just plugging in the result of dx naught by dt from up here, and so this is what we have here on the right hand side. So in an analogous way, we can calculate the spatial derivative and obtain dx by dx naught by dx, which is u naught prime over 1 plus as we derived up here. So putting all of this together, conclude that ut plus f prime of ux equals 0 and u is a c1 function according to the theorem. And our point x comma t was also t sufficiently small. So our point x comma t was also arbitrary. So this concludes the theorem. So at least locally, we can expect such C1 functions, such continuously differentiable functions to exist. Okay, so that brings me to define a new class of solutions. Those that include this phenomenon of characteristics crossing and the generation of discontinuous solutions. So this is our chapter 4.2. Weak solutions. So just to restate what I've already explained in words, the previous examples suggest that one should allow discontinuous solutions to exist. So the basic idea here is that instead of C1 functions, we will look at integral versions of the equations, and therefore essentially only require solutions to be integrable rather than differentiable. So the idea is essentially consider the integral form of the conservation law then functions must only be integrable . So in particular, we will look at functions that are bounded or essentially bounded. So they will be in this category of L infinity functions on R across our time interval 0 to infinity. And they can be vector valued functions. Vector functions on Rm, because we're looking into systems of equations. So meaning that the L infinity norm, which is the infimum of any constant C such that U of X, the absolute value of U of X is smaller equals Z almost everywhere. And so we require those to be smaller than infinity. So this is what is called the essentially bounded functions. So we allow them So we require them to be bounded on essentially everywhere except for sort of a subset of measure zero that doesn't contribute to the integral. So in order to sort of motivate this a little more, to motivate essentially this integral form of the conservation law and sort of the definition of this function space, let's for now assume again that we have a classical solution. So let's say we have some smooth solution U. Of the initial value problem. And let's consider some test function V. And we'll assume that they have compact support. So essentially, and we'll multiply our conservation law with those and then integrate. And so these test functions will essentially read out different spatial parts essentially of our solution. So this is C naught infinity on R cross zero to infinity Rm. So then if we multiply our conservation law with such a function, we still have a vanishing equation. We can integrate this. Over the entire domain or a subset thereof. And now since we assumed a C1 solution, this is all well defined. And we can integrate by parts. To obtain the following, we're just sort of moving over the derivatives to this test function, which we assume to be smooth. And so we essentially end up with an expression, and this is exactly the trick. We end up with an expression where U doesn't appear with any derivatives. But that is equivalent to the previous integral formulation. And these boundary terms vanish because we assume that V has a compact support. So if we just choose the region in which we integrate to be large enough, then those terms will vanish. And so what we end up with is the following expression, and this is exactly the motivation for the definition of weak solutions. So in this expression, we have completely transferred derivatives to the test functions. And so here we have a boundary term, the initial data term. And this last expression exactly motivates the following definition. Consider the initial value problem with some initial data that is bounded, or essentially bounded, then U in L infinity is called a weak solution or often called integral solution or solution in the distributional sense if and only if for all test functions with compact support on our domain of existence for solutions. Okay, and so obviously, as we've shown here, but just to state the obvious, if U is actually a weak solution, that happens to be differentiable, say C1, then U is a classical solution of the initial value problem. By essentially this identity, by this identity that we've shown here. Okay. And so just to reiterate again, the real motivation here really is that we don't require anything in terms of derivatives on our function U. We've shifted essentially all derivatives to these test functions, and we only require in this formulation here, in this weak formulation, we really only require that U is essentially bounded, so bounded with an exception of measure zero subset, and we only require that these integrals here exist, and so that in particular includes discontinuous functions, obviously. So in the very last part for today, let's move on fairly quickly to briefly discuss behaviors of and properties of such functions near discontinuities. Namely, turns out that that the conservation laws dictate certain very useful properties actually for such weak solutions. Once we have a discontinuity in the solution, and those properties, or say those relations that I'm alluding to, are the so-called Rankine Hugoniot relations. So this is can be formulated in terms of the following theorem. And those relations are very important, as we'll later see, when discussing such solutions. So let's say we have some domain V. In which we have a weak solutions of the initial value problem. And let's say we have some discontinuity that maybe has arisen because of a wave steepening or so that gave rise to the crossing of characteristics. And then from there on, we have some discontinuity in the solution. And let's say that discontinuity is given by such a smooth curve, sigma. Which divides the domain into two parts that we denote by VL for V left and V right. So let me just try to illustrate this. So the situation is the following. We're in our XT space, we have some domain V on which we have found a weak solution to the initial value problem. And let's say that we have such a curve sigma that on which the solution is discontinuous, but it's actually differentiable in the rest of the domain on V left and on V right. So this is our curve sigma of t. So we just write this down that you okay, sorry. Okay, sorry, there we are. So let's assume that we have a weak solution such that U on the left side is actually, so this is U restricted to VL, is actually C1. If we even included the our curve sigma, so the boundary of the domain. And let's assume the same is true for the right-hand side. So that UR, which is U restricted to BR, is also C1. And UL and UR locally satisfy the initial value problem on both domains separately. In the classical sense, then U is a weak solution of the initial value problem if and only if the following condition is satisfied, which I'll refer to as the Rankine Hugoniot relation, namely that the flux evaluated on the left-hand side approaching the discontinuity from the left-hand side essentially, minus the flux function evaluated on the right-hand side approaching the discontinuity equals sigma prime of t, which is what's often referred to as the shock speed. So the propagation speed of this would be sigma prime of t. The propagation speed of the discontinuity you write of sigma of t comma t for all t greater than 0. Okay, so just for notation, this relation is often written FL minus FR equals sigma prime UL minus UR, essentially in short form, along sigma, or often the following notation is introduced. You'll see this often in textbooks, for example. These double brackets are just referred to as essentially the jump or change of a quantity across the discontinuity. So this is just the jump across sigma. Okay, let's in the last few minutes just really quickly show how this how these conditions, these very useful conditions, actually arise. So this is seen fairly easily. So again, let's take some test function that has some compact support on V. And so in particular, it does not necessarily vanish on our discontinuity. And say, let's denote by nu, which will have two components, nu1 and nu2, the outer unit normal to VL. So making use of the definition of sigma, you can write this as 1 over square root of 1 plus sigma prime of t. And then we have the components 1 and minus sigma prime of t. So then we can write the integral form of our conservation law in the following sense. So we'll start by assuming that U is a solution in the distributional sense. So it's a weak solution. So then we have, by definition, that U times Vx plus f of U times, Vt, Vx, integrated over our domain plus the boundary term V of x, comma 0, dx. Now this is 0 essentially by construction, since V is compact support on our domain V. And so that can be always sort of made small enough to not contain an overlap with the initial data. So we can ignore that term for now. So then we'll split the integral into a contribution from the left part of the domain V and the right part. So this is U times Vt plus f of U times Vx dx dt, plus the same thing for the other part. Now we can rewrite this in the following form. We have VL and then UT, so f of U X DT plus a boundary term on the boundary of VL, where we have U times V, then we have multiply by the unit normal. So just writing out this scalar product. And then we have mu 1 integrating along the discontinuity. And we have a similar term for the part on the right. But now since the outer unit normal change signs, we have again the same term in here, same form but with a minus sign. So the outer unit normal for the region on the right is minus the unit normal on the left, which we call minus nu, which we call nu. So this is minus nu and gives us an additional minus sign. And so we can write this in the following form, where we know that U is a classical solution on the interior part of VL, which is why we could reformulate this here in terms of these derivatives again. So by construction, this vanishes, and also this part vanishes. So we're just left with this integral along our discontinuity sigma, which just rearranging terms gives us UL minus UR times U2 plus the corresponding flux terms here and here, which is F of UL minus F of UR times U1 dotted with our test function V, DL. And now we deduce, since V is arbitrary, the part in the interior here has to vanish. So this means F of UL minus F of UR equals, so plugging in also the expressions for U1 and U2, equals sigma prime times UL minus UR. And that concludes the proof of the theorem. Okay, and since time is up, we'll stop here and start discussing the entropy condition next time. So we'll see that these new class of weak solutions are actually not unique given an initial value problem. And so we'll have to specify, sort of define some criterion by which we select a solution that we think is sort of the physical solution to the problem. And this is exactly the role of the entropy condition. So we will discuss this next time. See you then.